on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
I'm biased, but I think art is perhaps the highest form of magic. And Alan Moore, the great comic book writer, talked about how magic used to be called the art, and that this is perhaps literal. And that there's this association with language and magic. For example, the god Thoth, the Egyptian god, is both the god of magic and of language and of symbol. So we use language and symbol to alter consciousness and to achieve ends, desires. But just think about how much impact a film can have on the world. Like The Matrix, for example, comes to mind, of a movie that I think really shifted the consciousness of an entire generation by making people question, what is this reality that we live in? How much agency within it do we really have? You know, and so a film as a work of art can really profoundly impact the world. Same with a song, same with a book. You know, there's a reason why so many fascist governments have banned books or like burnt books, because they're powerful. Yeah. Ideas are powerful. And oftentimes there's a control on ideas. People don't want people to have certain ideas. And right. I guess fundamentally, this is what art is. It communicates ideas.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by artist and author Jake Coburn to discuss his book, The Path Within: Ritual Magic and the Gateway to Self-Mastery. Jake shares his personal journey of overcoming depression by discovering magic. He emphasizes that magic is about realigning with one's true will and essence, often through art and ritual. The conversation also touches on the integration of ethics into magical practice and the role of art as a potent form of magic. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Jake Coburn is a multifaceted artist renowned for his psychedelic and esoteric artwork, which is distinguished by its intricate, meticulous details. A devoted practitioner of magic, Jake's artistic journey is deeply influenced by an eclectic mix of Western esotericism, including occult and mystery school traditions, and Eastern spiritual paths like Buddhism, Hinduism, animism, and Tantra. He is a teacher, podcaster, writer, tattoo artist, musician, DJ, and designer. In 2022, he founded the art collective and occult order, the Temple of the Eternal Muse, abbreviated TOTEM. He joins me today to discuss his book, The Path Within: Ritual Magic and the Gateway to Self-Mastery. Jake, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
I'm really grateful to be here. Thanks for having me, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad that you're here. I mentioned before I hit record that I've got a interest in magic. I've got an interest in the esoteric in general. And in your book, and we'll get to this, you've got some guest teachers, and some of who I know and I've interviewed. They've been on the show a few times. So I'm really looking forward to this. And yeah. I want to know a little bit about your background and what led you to the study of magic. But I think before we get to that, what might be important to talk about is, what's magic in the first place? And I have several definitions from your book here, but I thought that that might be the best place to start, just to kind of lay the groundwork on what we're talking about here.
Sure. I think the question, what is magic, is one of those questions that's similar to what is art? And it's very challenging to define. I think that Aleister Crowley defined magic as the art and science of change in accordance with will. And this is a clear and useful definition. But then, you know, if you want to change your state, you go order a coffee. So is that an act of magic as well? According to Crowley, it is actually any kind of willed action that is to create deliberate change through our intention in our lives is a form of magic. In the book, I focus more on ritual magic, which is how to use these kinds of poetic dramas to create changes in our consciousness. And then those changes in consciousness may have effects that ripple out into our lives. So I think when people use the word magic, it often refers to something non-ordinary, something special, something rarefied, like that was magical. And so I think this is also an important component of it, is that to me, my personal definition of magic, beyond it being just a willed action that creates change, is something that has an element of the sacred to it, something that also brings about a sense of specialness, of divinity, that heightens our awareness into something larger than what we immediately perceive within the mundane world. But as I said, there are many definitions of magic, and it's hard to define,
Yeah, it
because
is.
I had a conversation actually with a friend last night, and she was like, "Well, do you really need to do a ritual to do magic?" And the answer is no, of course not. There are many ways to create shifts in our consciousness that will result in changes in our lives. Just a decision is enough to create magic. But the ritual creates a density of meaning that then allows for the universe to rhyme in accordance with that density of meaning. So it contributes to the ongoing poetry of life in that way. And for me, just as somebody who's inclined towards that, like I have an affinity towards poetic ritual and these kinds of things, like it just, strikes a chord with me. And people may read the book, they may try some of these things out, it might resonate with them or it might not. I hope I've given a wide enough breadth of different practices and approaches for people to try out and to see what works for them.
Yeah, I think you succeeded in that. I've read some other books on magic, and there are some that are pretty well known. I'm not going to drop any names here, but I've often found those get a little bit too technical and a little bit too, I don't know, rigid maybe in the ritual aspect. And I like what you said, and I love the way that you were speaking and saying these things with, this allows the universe to rhyme and there's a density of meaning. And I noted a couple of things in some of your definitions from the book. You referred to it as a form of reality hacking, and an inner shift. And of course, the use of symbols to alter our consciousness. And in the title itself, you talk about magic being the gateway to self-mastery. And I wanted to ask you about that. How can magic help us towards that end?
Well, I think in many spiritual traditions, there's a universal aim of the spiritual path of being sort of the unity with self as a capital S self, to come back to the truth of who we truly are, to experience some form of what they may call enlightenment, what Carl Jung called individuation, what they may call in magical traditions the realization of the true will, or the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel, many different names to basically talk about approaching something probably quite similar, if not the same. And so, in order to have self-mastery, you have to know thyself. And so, this is what the practice of magic, especially high magic, which is what this book goes into detail about, allows us to understand. It's like who we really are at our deepest level and how to discern what is illusion or what is not who we truly are, and the ways in which that plays out in our roles in life, and how to begin to unravel that and to at least forge a connection to that true sense of self. And so it's not master in the sense of control or dominate, but it's master in a sense of knowledge that the aims and practices of ceremonial magic are designed to ascend our consciousness, to allow us to experience apotheosis and to receive insight into the true nature of self. And whether or not it succeeds at that is something I think that needs to be experienced and experimented with. And what that even looks like in terms of how that plays out in a person's life is also very individual. So it's hard to say if somebody's achieved that goal or not, because it's something that really is just in a person's consciousness, not so much in terms of how it plays out in life circumstances.
Okay, I have a couple of questions, but before we get to them, because I've got this really pressing question, but before we get to those, let me ask you what I wanted to ask in the first part of the question, aside from, what is magic, but what led you to exploring magic? Because you dedicate the book to your teenage self.
Well, to give context to that, my teenage years were really hard for me. I used to be more than 100 pounds heavier than I am now, and just experienced a lot of really severe depression and a lot of misery. Definitely, it was the most mentally and physically unwell time of my life. And I did really grapple with suicidal thoughts and things like that. So I'm glad I kind of survived that time. So this book was intended to be, when I was writing it, a book that if I had found it then could have really helped me by sharing all the tools that I've learned since then on how to change your state, change your life, take control of your destiny in a certain kind of way. And so the book was written to help anyone, but really to help anyone that finds themselves in a period of crisis or in a period of uncertainty or limitation or depression, of what tools you can use to actually help you move forward from that place and regain a sense of empowerment and perhaps control and agency and optionality over your life. So that's why I dedicated it to my teenage self. How I discovered magic was kind of just a real synchronistic process. How does one discover these things? Anybody listening to this podcast, how did you even get here? There's a kind of almost fate to it. So I feel like on some level, perhaps I just had a kind of soul contract to discover these things or perhaps rediscover them, if it's perhaps some past life kind of remembrance of this tradition. But I was always an avid reader and I loved fantasy books. So I think when I was very young, I just, kind of fell in love with the archetype of the wizard and became really interested in magic through the kind of fantasy lens. And then when I was quite young, I used to go hang out at Borders Books with my father. It was an era that will never come again. And just, we'd read together, we'd look at books. And I always found myself in the sort of spiritual new age occult section of Borders, and that's where I discovered Aleister Crowley, because they had some of his books like Liber 777 and these, books that I could not understand at the time, but was just fascinated by them. And then when I was a teenager, I got really into metal music and different forms of kind of extreme metal, like black metal and death metal, and also progressive metal. The band Tool has always been a big influence on me, and I'm a big fan of Tool, but they, especially their drummer, has been inspired by magic and has they've spoken a lot about Aleister Crowley and their interviews and things like that. So I think I kind of discovered Aleister Crowley as well through Tool and started reading Crowley's books when I was a teenager in high school. And started actually doing what he says to do and actually exploring the practices, especially meditation. And meditation had a profound impact on my life at the time because my mental state at that time was very unpleasant. My mind was not a good place to be. And meditation just cleansed me of all of that affliction, allowed for me to reach a calm, centered, focused place where I wasn't in a state of mental anguish. And the results of that were pretty immediate. I also started exploring lucid dreaming very heavily at that time and had a lot of very reality reframing experiences, I guess you could say, like really made me question my assumptions about reality, having very vivid experiences of other realms and dimensions. And what is this reality of these lucid dreams that can feel more vivid or more real than even our waking lives at times. So this was also quite an initiatory experience for me. And then my father, who's also a psychologist, has had a long-standing interest, probably since the 1970s, in Buddhism. And so I started going with him to Buddhist meditations and lectures, specifically with the teacher Jack Kornfield, who's a wonderful teacher of Theravadan Buddhism. And this also had a really profound impact on me and led me deeper into the Dharma and into Eastern spirituality. And then eventually realizing that all of the teachers of Eastern spirituality that were, Westerners, really for the most part, had all their awakenings through psychedelic experiences. That led me also to eventually explore in an intentional way things like psilocybin mushrooms and LSD, and to have a lot of very profound healing and reality shifting experiences through those medicines. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. Otherwise, it's been quite a synchronistic process of discovery and having access to teachers, mentors, books, resources that have allowed me to dive deeply into this subject. And I am initiated in formal traditional magical orders and have received formal training in traditions of ceremonial magic, as well as having mentorship in other forms of magic as well. And it's an ongoing process of experimentation and discovery. And one last thing I'll say is that for me, it's also quite related to psychology for me. Like magic for me is kind of a, guess like a holistic practice. It's not, I don't separate psychology and spirituality. So for me, whatever I'm doing is kind of a healing process for myself, or working out things in my mind and psyche. Like, to me, this is also part of the magic.
Yeah, we often forget, I think, that the root of psychology, psyche, is soul.
Yeah, psychologist means something like soul doctor, right?
But it's very rare to find a psychologist who actually talks about the soul. It's now just brain and chemicals in the brain. But I think that we lose something really important when we take that approach to the human. And I like the idea, and I didn't know if I kind of wish I had stumbled upon this. We're always on our own paths and we find things when we're supposed to find them. But I really wish I knew this when I was working on my doctorate, because if I had, I would have written a very completely different dissertation. But it is this syncretism of sorts with Western esotericism and magic with the Asian traditions, especially Hinduism and Tantra and Buddhism. And I know that Crowley talks about yoga, but for him, it's not just an exercise about getting bendy. My understanding is the purpose really of yoga, and the yoga that most people are familiar with, really is to prepare the body to be able to sit in meditation for long periods of time.
Yeah. I mean, I heard that, whether this is true or not, I heard that the form of yoga called Hatha yoga, the kind of bendy, I think it's Iyengar yoga that most people practice, was basically designed to pacify like teenage boys who had like too much sexual energy so they'd stop masturbating or something like that. I don't know if that's true, but I've heard that. Yeah, Aleister Crowley studied Raja Yoga. So there are different forms of yoga. Yoga meaning union, right? Or to yoke or something like this. And he studied Raja Yoga. His teacher, Alan Bennett in the Golden Dawn, became a Buddhist monk, actually. So he went to Sri Lanka to study Raja Yoga and to study the practices of meditation that they teach. And Raja Yoga is all about concentrating your attention on a single point of awareness and dissolving into different states of consciousness through concentration. So it's not so much, there's not really that much of a asana, which is physical posture. Crowley does teach about asana, and I also reference this in the book, but he basically just prescribes four different postures that you only need to take one of them and become proficient in. And there's a process of learning that is built in stages, the first stage being to master the asana, to master the posture. So to be able to sit perfectly still for, let's say, an hour at a time or more, and to have command over your body and discipline your body to be able to hold that posture is the first step. And that's really the only reference to asana in Crowley's version of yoga compared to, as you mentioned, the prevalence of it in Western culture. And that's, an exercise or calisthenics or stretching that most people consider yoga these days.
Yeah, and I know that with his studies in Buddhism, he was just looking at Theravada, and eventually he became pretty critical of Buddhism. He didn't like that, from what he learned, that the focus was on, everything is sorrow, but that's not really what Buddhism teaches. But I often wondered, what would happen if he had been exposed to, for example, Tibetan Buddhism, because there seems to be a lot of parallels to magical practice with Tibetan Buddhism. For example, I know they have dream yoga, which is all about instilling, learning how to induce lucid dreams.
There's a lot of magical elements to Tibetan Vajrayana Buddhism and also many different factions of that. But it's also the integration with bone shamanism, which was the traditional shamanic practices of that culture before Buddhism came to Tibet. But if you look at magic as a kind of tool, something universal and something not inherently good or bad, I think is important to see in this way, because magic, just like language, has the ability to heal or hurt. It can do, it can be used for harmful or benefic actions. And so I don't know a lot about Tibetan Vajrayana Buddhism, but from what I do know about it, it's kind of taking the goal of enlightenment and using magic to increase that possibility, to basically use these kinds of magical tools and practices to accelerate the process of awakening and to increase compassion and understanding.
I don't know a lot about, I know some, but not too much. I don't know any of the details, but I find that very interesting. But something you said, I think, is really important, and that is that magic is kind of neutral. It could be used for good, it can be used for bad, just like language can be used for good and used for bad. And one of the things that I really appreciated about your book is there is this emphasis on ethics. And you connect that to the true will. And so I was hoping that you could speak a little bit to the ethics. And that does actually connect to what I did with my doctoral dissertation. But I'm going to let you start. And I still have this question that's going to be connected to all of this.
Yeah, I think magic is something very powerful. And so, it being something very powerful, having clear ethical guidelines, which also I'm trying to frame through a more thelemic perspective, which allows for people to discover their own values and to live in accordance with them. So I'm not being dogmatic in my prescription of these are the rules or these are the ethics, but generally speaking, when it comes to magic, doing magic that manipulates another person, that reduces their agency or free will, or that harms another person in any kind of way, or a community of people or the world, it's not really good magic to do, both for yourself and for others. And I talk about the reasons why enacting harm on another person is enacting harm to yourself. And so if the end goal of all this stuff is to be ha happy and healthy and well, and to, which is what I think most people want, really. And if they're coming to magical practice and wanting to engage in this stuff, even if they're filled with hatred and they want to use magic to hurt another person that they feel hurt by, chances are on some level they're trying to just alleviate that pain. And so getting really clear about what it is that you want, and then making sure that lines up ethically. You know, do you really want that particular person to fall in love with you, or do you really just want to feel, I don't know, safe or connected or love, you know? And you can do magic on yourself that doesn't involve another person's agency to achieve those results. You know, do you really want to curse that person, or do you want to feel the alleviation of pain? Maybe you should do magic for healing the grief or the pain, the anger that you feel, rather than needing to enact harm on another person than feeling like that's going to help. So I talk about these things, and I think it's important because I've read many books about magic and I've not really seen ethical considerations being very central to most books about magic, you know, and I'm also of the opinion that people need to learn through their own mistakes and experiments. So, you know, I'm not saying I've never done magic that was harmful in some way. Like, you know, I have, and that's why I wrote about this, to teach people about the dangers of it and to try to reduce harm as much as possible.
No, I appreciate that. So thank you for all of that. And one of the things that you say in the book, this is a direct quote, "My primary goal is not to turn you into a magician, but to help you become a happier and more empowered person." And I definitely appreciate that. Now, what you do, though, is in the book, and here's the connections I want to start making here, you bring in this concept of eudaimonia. And you connect that to the Stoics, which is not that's correct, but I always take it to Aristotle because he was the first one to really talk about that. And it was part of this idea of virtue. And I noticed that that's kind of the moral theory that's sort of running through your book. It's more about being a virtuous person. And the idea is that, you know, if you want to flourish in your life, and that's kind of the more common translation of eudaimonia now, is to flourish, you have to be a good person. You have to have good qualities of character, and that's what's going to allow you to achieve that flourishing. Just because you're a good person doesn't mean you're going to flourish, but you can't flourish without it. But you connect this idea of eudaimonia with the true will. And I was wondering if maybe you could explain that.
Well, I have a kind of psychological theory, which is that when people are empowered to live in accordance with their true will and unrestricted in that and flourishing in that, this is kind of the highest state of psychological satisfaction because you're living the life you're meant to live, you're being who you're meant to be, you're in your natural essence. And the true will is not, you know, it's not like, oh, it's my true will to be a dentist. Like, you may be a dentist and living that is part of your true will, but it's more about being who you really are. The ways in which we get distorted or led away from that path is socialization and trauma, generally. Those are the two things. And, you know, I think a good therapy helps heal both of those and helps connect us back into our essence. So there's a kind of reclaiming our power that comes through the pursuit of this. But it also tends to be not only good for us, but good for others. And so that's why there's this link to virtue. Because the true will, generally speaking, is, and it can be, you know, I can get into a lot of kind of abstract, you know, perspectives around this because it's not so black and white, right? Like, was Hitler living his true will? He may have been, actually, you know, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be a perfectly like nice person, because the quality of nice is a social construct, right? But we are also social beings, and I think that what humans want most of the time is to feel a sense of belonging and connection and love and affinity and to feel seen and respected and admired and, these kinds of things is like mostly what makes people happy and what it feels like to thrive. And so that's also where I think a lot of the considerations around ethics come from, is just how do you exist in the world and with other people? And so chances are your true will and the enactment of your true will is also going to have a lot to do with service. Service towards others, service towards something greater than yourself. And so that's why there's also this connection to ethical practice. I'll say one last kind of caveat. Being a virtuous person will not exempt you from pain, misunderstanding, misfortune. And so the virtue is unconditional. It's about embodying that because it's the right thing to do, and it's within you're living in accordance with your values, which I think is really important and something I also emphasize in the book. But it doesn't mean that bad things aren't going to happen to you, and good intentions often results in all kinds of chaos that we can't control and misfortune that we can't control. But also in the book, I talk about using divination methods. What I'm saying is that basically you can do a magical act for what you believe to be a good intention, and it could still have negative impacts either on yourself or on others. So hopefully using divination, like doing a tarot reading about some type of ritual that you intend to perform, can help reduce harm by giving you an idea of what the outcome may be. So that's one of the reasons why I teach divination in the book.
And you make that point a few times, which I appreciate because it's absolutely true that, what I forget who said, I think it was Milton or something, that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So, we can have good intentions, but they can have very negative consequences.
Yeah, I'll say something about that, which is that people interested in magic are usually kind of like a little controlling. Like it's most of the motivation to get into magic comes from a place of desiring more personal power and agency and control. And that's fine. Those are l legitimate things. You need to have at least a degree of competence over your own life and a certain amount of control in order to feel, in order to thrive. But the higher stages of magic, I think, when you get it onto a kind of initiatory tract with it, is more about a quality of surrender or ego death. And there's actually a releasing of control and a surrendering into that kind of true will or that essence. And so this requires a lot of letting go over attachment to outcomes. And Crowley said, pure will unassuaged from purpose is in every way perfect. So the quality of performing magic, because it is what your soul calls for, without being attached to the fruits of that magic.
Well, I like the one of the ways that I think about eudaimonia, and I think this connects with what you were just saying is, yes, it's now translated more often than not as flourishing. It used to be just be translated as happiness, but if you look at the actual Greek, what it means is it's a good daimon. And one way you could, and I don't know if this is entirely correct, but I always like to think of it as a good spirit, in the sense of having a kind of a good spiritedness. So it seems that, if we have that agency, if we know our true will, and we're acting from that place of having this sort of power, and we're doing it, with a ethical grounding, that that's going to lead to this idea of having a sort of a good spirit.
Yeah, I like that interpretation. The other thing that that brings up for me is the daimon, which is co-equal with the holy guardian angel, as it's called, in ceremonial magic traditions. And the idea is that our true will is discovered through a relationship with the daimon, whether you want to consider that daimon to be a conscious external entity, which you can certainly have the experience of, or as part of your higher mind or part of your soul or your soul itself. But you're listening to and in relationship to something higher than yourself and in service to that, which is the daimon, which guides you and knows you better than you know yourself and has known you for eternity and is you also. But that's a key. And that also helps dismantle this idea of control, because the shadow magician believes themselves to be all powerful. But the true magician understands that they're just a conduit, that they are in relationship to higher forces that are much more powerful than they are. And they're sort of, it's like being a surfer, you know. The surfer doesn't control the ocean. They have a good relationship to it.
Yeah, I like that. And I think that, and the question I have for you, it's kind of outside of your book, but I can't help myself here, because probably the daemon that is best known to most people, even those outside of, they're not very familiar with the esoteric, is with Socrates, his daemon. And it's him listening to his daemon is one of the reasons that he was sentenced to death in Athens. And but the daemon was telling him, it never told him necessarily what to do, but it kind of prevented him from doing things. But the question that kind of came to my mind was, so does that mean that Socrates was a magician?
Yeah, sure. Why
Yeah.
not? Like I said earlier in this interview, I don't believe it's necessary to do ritual magic
Right.
in any kind of
Yeah.
traditional context in order to do magic. Also, the book Mastery by Robert Greene is a good example of many people who had this deep, enduring connection with their daimon or their genius and were living in accordance with their true will in a way that allowed them to flourish and provide benefit for the world. And yet, there's nothing esoteric
Right.
really overtly within the book or within the stories of these people. You know, someone like Mozart was in alignment with his true will. And that's the whole point of magic,
Yeah.
you know, to
Yeah.
not, I think it's important to keep that in perspective, but that's the point. It's not about knowing all of, you know, the most advanced Enochian rituals or whatever. Like, that's great. But, and maybe that is that person's sort of true will to do that. But you can lose yourself in the techniques and in the minutiae of all the ritual and theory and the different traditions. But really, when it comes down to it, it's just being in alignment with your genius
Yeah.
and enacting that in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, the daemon, that's Greek, genius is the Latin, and genius is connected to the word genesis. There's a shared root, which is creation. And I think that gets to that core that you've spoken about previously, is that allows us to connect to our agency. And this is what really interests me about magic, is because so many of us, I think, feel a lack of agency in our lives and feel kind of trapped in the societies we live in and want to be able to express something that's inside. But sometimes knowing what that is difficult. And it seems like magic can help us determine what our true will actually is. And that is that like the one of the first steps on the magical path, is learning what your true will is.
Absolutely. Yeah. I advise people to write down all of their desires, for example, all of their fears. These are all clues to who we really are at our essence, because your desires are unique to you, your fears are unique to you, and those are guideposts, as well as examining. Astrology can be useful as well. There can be clues in looking at somebody's natal chart, for example, as well as even symbolic associations with people's names or the gematria behind it can be interesting to look at. But I think perhaps the most important is to look at the clues that are in our childhood. Who were we when we were children? What were we fascinated by? What were we inspired by? this will reveal a lot to us in terms of what can carry forth, what the seeds were then that can carry forth as an adult. And beyond the book Mastery, there's another great book about what I, it's not explicitly mentioning the true will, but to me it's about that. The Soul's Code by James Hillman is another great book that can help kind of aid you in this process of discovery. And it's not always clear. And it you know, our true will is who we are beyond any of the conditions of our life. It's like, who are you when you're doing the dishes, when you're at work, when you're with your lover, when you're on a podcast? That's your true will, you know? So the external forms will shift because everything in life is transient. You may not have the same career all the time. You may not live in the same place all the time. And probably, though, things are going to be more flowy, more synchronistic, more magical, if you will, when you're really in alignment with that versus when you're not. And when things are really blocked and when there's a lot of friction, it might be a clue that you're maybe not living in accordance with that.
And that is, I think, a really good example of magic is psychology. I know that I think one of the meditations that you have in the book is to just kind of keep asking yourself, well, who am I? Who am I? And I think that's something that it's, I've done this with students before. I kind of try to encourage them to ask that question. And it's like, don't tell me, you know, these characteristics like, oh, I'm a nice person or, you know, anything like that. But who are you? And keep asking that. And don't identify yourself by your things, because that's often what I would find with some of the students is, you know, oh, I like Marvel movies. I'm like, okay, but is that really who you are? You know, who are you? And it gets back to that know thyself.
Yeah, and I guess there is relevance to, like, you can use the liking of Marvel movies as a clue to deeper understanding of the true will. What is it about the Marvel movies that you like? Because, you know, you can get 10 people that like Marvel movies, and people are all going to perhaps have a different reason why. Maybe they resonate with the hero's journey, or like maybe they, if it's a particular character, the kind of like, you know, the flawed yet empowered, or, you know, I don't know. It's going to be different for every single person. Maybe some person likes the costume design. Maybe some people like the world building. So that's also going to reveal clues. I think all of everything, what we're attracted to, what we're repulsed by, what we're afraid of, what turns us on, what inspires us, like all of it is fodder for understanding and discovering ourself and understanding and discovering our true will.
It's, and it seems like it's a lifetime journey. It's not something that you ever suddenly like, oh, that's it, that's who I am. It seems like it's something that is constantly evolving and that we're constantly learning about ourselves. And if that's true, it kind of seems to suggest that, we're kind of infinite in many ways.
And the soul desires expansion. So something may feel totally aligned in terms of what your true will is at a particular stage of your life, and then you outgrow that, and then the soul desires growth into new areas of your life to discover new parts of yourself.
So let me ask you about the book you've got, and I, again, I really enjoyed the book, but you have some guest teachers, and I've had a few of them on the show. And I was just wondering if you could maybe speak very, you don't have to go into horrible detail about what they write, but who were these guest teachers and maybe why you invited them and their voices in this work?
So we had Mitch Horowitz, who gave a guest lecture on mental magic, new thought. I invited him because He's been an inspiration of mine, someone I've really looked up to and learned a lot from and read a lot of his books. And he is an expert at that particular tradition of magic. That's why I invited him. We also had Carl Abrahamson, who gave a lecture about the history of magic and its roots. And I invited him likewise because he's a inspiring teacher and someone I've learned a lot from and is very deeply connected to a culture and the traditions of chaos magic and its relevance in art and creativity, which as an artist myself has been really inspiring for me. And then we had my friend Sean Fargo, who was a Buddhist monk for 2 years, studying the jhana state, so like very rarefied forms of consciousness through really deep concentration meditation. He studied this in Thailand. And I invited him to give a guest talk about meditation because he probably knows more about meditation than anyone else I know, and given his extensive experience as a monk. And Dr. David Schumacher, who I worked with personally for a couple years, and I invited him to talk about ritual forms because I also really appreciate his work and his exposition on thelema and making that tradition understandable and accessible and tied to Western psychology. And then finally, we had Mark Stavish, who gave a lecture about lucid dreaming and astral projection and how that relates to the Kabbalah. And yeah, again, he's a excellent teacher of Hermeticism, someone that I've learned from and admired and looked up to. So I pretty much just invited people that I respect very deeply, people that I've learned from myself personally, and thought could contribute something that would be enriching both for myself and for readers.
Yeah. And it was. And I'm familiar with Mitch and Carl, but the other three I wasn't. But I found that it was very helpful to give a perspective of what you were writing about. And I enjoyed that quite a bit. And I did like the idea of art and magic that Carl Abrahamson talks about quite a bit. And that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you about. And this is. We're not going to get into all of the details because we want people to read the book and to see what it has to offer. But I was interested in art as a form of magic. And there you talk about sigils. And that's what Carl talks about, is that it can, a sigil can be in any kind of art form. So I was wondering if maybe you could, and especially since you're an artist yourself, that maybe you can talk about the role of art and magic and perhaps sigils too.
I'm biased, but I think art is perhaps the highest form of magic. And Alan Moore, the great comic book writer, talked about how magic used to be called the art, and that this is perhaps literal, and that there's this association with language and magic. For example, the god Thoth, the Egyptian god, is both the god of magic and of language and of symbol. So we use language and symbol to alter consciousness and to achieve ends, desires. But just think about how much impact a film can have on the world. Like The Matrix, for example, comes to mind, of a movie that I think really shifted the consciousness of an entire generation by making people question, what is this reality that we live in? How much agency within it do we really have? And so a film as a work of art can really profoundly impact the world. Same with a song, same with a book. There's a reason why so many fascist governments have banned books or like burnt books, because they're powerful. Ideas are powerful. And oftentimes there's a control on ideas. People don't want people to have certain ideas. And I guess fundamentally, this is what art is. It communicates ideas, whether that's in the form of a painting or a performance, a dance, a song, a film. So this being wielded intentionally by an artist that intends to utilize their artwork to create change in the world and perhaps for themselves as well, this can be very powerful. And one of my favorite magical techniques is called a hypersigil. And a hypersigil is a long-form narrative work of art that is utilized to shift reality through constructing a kind of simulation of reality in the artwork and having it be charged through people's consumption of the art. So Grant Morrison, the chaos magician and comic book writer, is kind of the guy that invented this or popularized it. And in his book series, The Invisibles, he created a character that represented himself and had that character go through all these different experiences and found that those experiences were mirrored in his own life, both good and bad. He ended up in the hospital with a lung infection after his character went through some harrowing physical injury. Also, he wanted like a girlfriend, so he created this girlfriend for his character and then like met a woman that looked just like her. So things like this.
Well, and it seems like that, and I know this is something that Carl also talks about, is he seems to connect magic, sort of the origins of it, I think what he calls the source magic, with shamanism. And I think that some of our early, the earliest art we have is in some of that, magnificent cave art in France and in Spain. And it seems like there's something magical about that, that magic has been present in art from the very beginning.
I absolutely agree, and I think that those cave paintings are examples of sigils, where in all likelihood they ascended to these places that were so harrowing to climb to in order to create these works of art that they believed would actually potentiate their hunt. Would, in all likelihood, they probably were following that magical logic of we're going to create these images, these paintings of what we want to happen, have happen. And then through charging it through intention, prayer, ritual, ceremony, whatever was going on in those caves, it gave people extra confidence or a magical boost to then achieve those ends. That's my suspicion around it. So the oldest roots of art are probably very tied to magic and magical thinking. And then another thing that my friend, the artist Alex Gray, once imparted to me was the idea of paintings being talismans, or any work of art being a talisman. So if your intention as an artist is to help expand people's consciousness, if you yourself get into a particular expanded state of consciousness, a very loving place, or a very high state of consciousness, and you create art while in that state of consciousness, you're crystallizing that state of consciousness that's then infectious to the viewer. And this is what talismans are as well. Like when you're consecrating, creating a talisman in magical ritual, you're anchoring that energy, that frequency into the object so that it can then have an effect on the wearer or people around the talisman. And that's absolutely what paintings are, especially works of visionary art. When you walk into the Sistine Chapel, you feel it. It's a talisman for divinity.
You can feel it in a lot of the artwork. I'm curious about, how do I want to say? So in the book, I'll start with this, I think. One of the things I appreciated is you give guidelines for various rituals. And some of them include, if I remember right, making art. But you very frequently say, don't get caught up in the guidelines. Don't get caught up in the rules. Do what feels right to you. And I liked that you gave your reader that permission, when creating a ritual, to do what feels correct to them. Because sometimes I found that when you have a book that has certain rituals in it, if you follow that, it just doesn't seem to have the potency that is supposed to be there. But when you make up your own, there's something very rich and powerful about that.
Yeah. The end goal of this book is that when somebody's read the entire book and assimilated all the information, they're able to then construct their own rituals. And that's the actually both first and final assignment in the whole book. The first assignment is to, before you learn anything about magical ritual, is to create your own ritual and to allow that to come from a place of creativity and inspiration and intuition. And then once you've learned all of the details of ritual form and their functions and the symbols and all these different things, then you can create your own ritual based on that as well if you want to utilize that. You know, and I allow people the opportunity to experiment and to discover for themselves what seems to work for them. I think that when you're following a ritual from a grimoire, you know, there could be value to really following that as closely to the instructions as possible because you're basically, it's like a recipe book. So I'm not saying that you should never follow rituals exactly as they're prescribed. And the rituals from ceremonial magic, for example, the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram or the middle pillar, there's a consistency and a cohesion to those rituals in terms of why there are particular symbols, particular words, particular directions that falls in alignment to the overall system. And so there's a logic to it that I think is worth respecting and understanding. So while I give people the opportunity to customize rituals, to create their own rituals, I'm also a firm believer in people studying and understanding at least the rules or the prescriptions that are given by other previous sources before they go into these other, you know, experiments around it. And I guess that's what makes me a chaos magician rather than, you know, a pure blood ceremonial magician, which I'm not. I study and practice ceremonial magic, but I'm not like a this is the way kind of a person. I'm really all for people discovering, you know, what works and what doesn't. And if you do something that doesn't work or has results that you don't like, you at least learn something from that experiment. So I think it's valuable.
Thank you for that. And it did remind me of the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram. I used to be in the habit of doing that, and I kind of got out of I got out of a lot of my better habits, and I need to get back into them. But the way that I always thought about it is that the ritual done in that specific way, it creates an energy about it. And with all these other people who are doing it and doing it in that specific way, that it gives the ritual a kind of power.
Yeah, there's an egregore that's charged through the participation of so many people. It also ties it to a tradition, you know? So within the tradition of Thelema, which is, I guess, primarily the tradition of ceremonial magic that I've studied, it's radically individual because, you know, do it thou well, it shall be the whole of the law. It's really intended just for you to be yourself. But so a person's path as a ceremonial magician, as a magician in general, in Thelema is going to look very different from person to person in terms of what types of things people are going to be doing. But the traditional rituals just help anchor people into a sense of community, into a sense of tradition, a shared symbolic system that can be helpful, a sangha of magical practitioners, if you will.
Yeah, what I'm kind of answering my own question as it's running through my head because I guess a community would be like an order. At first I was like coven. I'm like, no, that's more Wicca. But I was curious because one of the thoughts that I was having and a question was, because the book is individual and the magic in there is something that an individual can do. So you can be a solitary practitioner. But I was also thinking that there is power with group ritual as well.
Sure. Yeah. I've been primarily a solitary magician throughout my life, but I've had experiences of group rituals and they can be very powerful. Definitely, group ceremonies, all kinds of communal practices, they can be really beautiful. Even attending like a meditation retreat can really strengthen your meditation where you're meditating with other people rather than just doing it by yourself.
Yeah, it seems like there's a time and a place for both, for the individual and for the collective.
Yeah, and
So,
there's an ongoing conversation, I think, now in terms of the relevancy of traditional orders, if this is really the way for modern people in our world. Order systems used to function as sort of libraries of information, I guess, and preserve traditions, and I'm grateful for that. And I can't really, again, I think it comes down to each person's own individual path because some people may be really attracted to orders, the social aspects of them, if that is an element. It's not an element of every order, but if there is a social aspect to it. But I've never been involved with the OTO or anything like that, so I can't really speak from firsthand experience if that's something I would either recommend or not. I think it's If it's something that people are attracted to, they should try it out and see how it goes.
Yeah, well, and I think that people find magic in different ways, and I'm more, I think I kind of came to it. I had interest when I was younger, but I really didn't have the opportunity because I was, I'm kind of wicked old, so there wasn't the internet when I was younger. My local library in a pothole in Ohio didn't really have a lot of these kinds of books, but the internet is available. But it seems like there's sometimes people may come to magic in wanting to achieve a certain end, and this is what we've talked about before. That there are consequences to even if you have good intentions, but if you are trying to manipulate someone else, like I really want to be with this person, that can come back and get you. And I'm hoping that I think the virtue of your book is that it gives people a really strong foundation. And can even if someone, initially has this idea of, I want to make this person really dig me, that the book is going to nudge them to do some self-examination and approach magic differently.
Yeah, I think just on a practical, even like non-magical level, like trying to manipulate the person that you desire tends to push them much farther away because people can smell that and they're like, this is, oof, I don't like this. So don't do that. Don't do it magically. Don't do it through other means, And yeah, I think magic's kind of like a Trojan horse in a way because people are attracted to it generally. Because they want personal power, they want control. Someone says, okay, Jimmy Page did magic, so I want to become the most famous guitar player in the world, so I'll do magic too. But then they start doing it, and that's not what happens. Instead, their life falls apart, and their ego is crushed and destroyed, and all of their concepts of self are stripped away because the real intention of magical practice is to understand the nature of the self, to be in contact with the soul, to get to the bottom of our existence and to really discover the truth. And this requires oftentimes a lot of stripping away the tower, this, and after the tower, though, what do you got? You got the star. When you've been, everything's fallen apart and you've been stripped naked, and then you stand in your essence. Your naked truth, like this is what magic is. And so I also, just like everybody else, came to magic through more selfish motivations, probably. I mean, at least on some level. And then I don't know if I would say learned the hard way, but at least realized at a certain point, oh, that's not what this is for. And so I think it's important to have an awareness of that going into it. These practices can help us achieve more personal power towards getting what we desire. And I'm not even going to pathologize that. I think there's something to actually honoring our desires and going for it in a way that is skillful and competent. And I think this is very important to be satisfied in life. And it's also not really what the higher aspirations of ritual magic are for. And it's really a spiritual path of evolution, of consciousness, and to know the truth of ourselves.
I appreciate that. Yeah, that's I think I sort of really came to it. I had experiences when I was younger with some Wiccan covens, but it didn't really fit the need for me. I did incorporate some elements in my own rituals, but it was as I began investigating religions and spiritualities around the world, I started having some questions, especially in the West, in terms of alternative traditions, because I know that it's been suggested, I think Carl Jung suggested this, that the best thing to do is, instead of trying to borrow from someone else's culture, to use your own. And I have never resonated with Christianity at all. And I thought, okay, but is there anything in the culture that I can resonate with? And that's when I started finding this tradition, this magical tradition, and not just with Crowley, but with the Hermetic texts and so on and so forth. And I thought, aha, there, that is part of the culture and that is part of the tradition. And I appreciate that it's got its roots in shamanism. I agree with you and Carl Abrahamson on that. And that's what fascinates me about all of this, is that it is a different narrative that has been kind of hidden. That's what makes it a cult, right? Throughout our history, but it's there for those who seek and they can find it.
I agree. I'm really attracted to, Tibetan Buddhism or these Eastern practices, but I would need to reference a Tibetan symbol dictionary to really understand all the symbols that are talked about or referenced or in rituals or practices to really understand what it's about. And so the symbols of Western esotericism are things that Western people tend to be more steeped in. Also, I think the mindset around it being something creative, meaning to actually manifest in the material world, is a very Western mindset as well, as opposed to Eastern mindsets, which are often more about surrender and letting go. So I've been more attracted to Western magic and the Western paths because of it already using the programming language and the symbol systems that we're immersed in from a very young age.
I appreciate that. Well, we've been talking for a little bit here, and it's early where you are. You're in Bali, but it's late where I am. I didn't get much sleep last night, so I think I'm gonna wrap this up. I very much am enjoying the conversation, though, and really appreciate it. But let me ask you the final questions that I always ask. What are you working on next? What do you have coming up?
So, I'm planning a few retreats in Bali, actually. So, starting in November, I'll host the first ceremonial magic retreat that I'll be doing. And then January, there'll be a chaos magic retreat. Those are separate curriculums. And if those are successful, that'll be ongoing into 2026. So, I would say that's the major thing to be aware of on the horizon.
Okay. And where can people go to find out more about you and these retreats?
I would say follow me on Instagram. My account being Cobrin tends to be where I share the most regularly. Additionally, I also have a newsletter that I send out every week, and I would really recommend subscribing to that as well, and the details of the retreat, as well as new pieces of writing every single week, or podcasts and art and many things are released each week there. So I'd recommend subscribing to my newsletter to stay updated.
Okay, and to subscribe to the newsletter is how can someone do that?
There's a link on my
On the
Instagram.
Instagram. Okay, all right,
Yeah.
that's what I was curious. Okay, perfect. Well, I'll put a link for your Instagram in the show notes and video description, as well as links to your book. Has the book been the book's been published, right? It's out now?
Yeah.
Okay,
Yeah, the
perfect.
book has been published. You can purchase it either through the publisher's website, which is Cross Crow Publishing, or on Amazon,
Right.
or many other distributors. You should be able to
Yeah.
find it or order it through your local kind of occult or magical bookshop too.
Okay. Yeah, I'll put the link from I always put the publisher, and then if it's available on bookshop.org, I always put that link in because no one needs to make Jeff Bezos any richer than he is.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
It's all
Yeah,
blurry, but
perfect. Yeah. Well, it was a good book. I really appreciated it, and it kind of prompted me to start my practice again. So I appreciate
great.
that very much. Yeah. So Jake, it was a pleasure speaking with you, and I thank you for your time. And hopefully, at some point, we'll be able to speak again.
Yeah, it was a pleasure as well, Nick. Thanks so much for having me.
And that's a wrap on episode 205 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button if you're watching on YouTube, and don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click that notification bell. You can also follow Rebel Spirit Radio on whatever audio platform you use for listening to podcasts. Right now, I have over 20,000 downloads on the audio platforms, yet I only have 13 followers, and one of those is me. It only takes a second to like, follow, or subscribe. It is totally free, but it really does help. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love. I do love it, but it's also a lot of labor. So if you find value in the conversations I provide here, I hope you can find it in your heart to send a little love my way. With more subscribers and followers, I could possibly get some sponsorship, and honestly, having some funds come my way to help with equipment, hosting, and other necessary subscriptions would be really helpful. You can also help by joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rebelspirit. The link is also in the episode description. You can also purchase a Super Thanks on YouTube to help support my work. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your Rebel Spirit.